This is Audible.
Macmillan Audio presents A Higher Loyalty, Truth, Lies, and Leadership by James Comey. Read for you by the author.
To my former colleagues, the career people of the Department of Justice and the FBI, whose lasting commitment to truth keeps our country great. Author's note: who am I to tell others what ethical leadership is? Anyone claiming to write a book about ethical leadership can come across as presumptuous, even sanctimonious. All the more so if that author happens to be someone who was quite memorably and publicly fired from his last job. I understand the impulse to think that any book written about one's life experience can be an exercise in vanity, which is why I long resisted the idea of writing a book of my own. But I changed my mind for an important reason. We are experiencing a dangerous time in our country, with a political environment where basic facts are disputed, fundamental truth is questioned, lying is normalized, and unethical behavior is ignored, excused, or rewarded. This is not just happening in our nation's capital, and not just in the United States. It is a troubling trend that has touched institutions across America and around the world. Boardrooms of major companies, newsrooms, university campuses, the entertainment industry, and professional and Olympic sports. For some of the crooks, liars, and abusers, there has been a reckoning. For others, there remain excuses, justifications, and a stubborn willingness by those around them to look the other way or even enable the bad behavior. So if there ever was a time when an examination of ethical leadership would be useful, it is now. Although I'm no expert, I have studied, read, and thought about ethical leadership since I was a college student and struggled for decades with how to practice it. No perfect leader is available to offer those lessons. So it falls to the rest of us who care about such things to drive the conversation and challenge ourselves and our leaders to do better. Ethical leaders do not run from criticism, especially self-criticism, and they don't hide from uncomfortable questions. They welcome them. All people have flaws, and I have many. Some of mine, as you'll discover in this book, are that I can be stubborn, prideful, overconfident, and driven by ego. I've struggled with those my whole life. There are plenty of moments I look back on and wish I had done things differently, and a few that I'm downright embarrassed by. Most of us have those moments. The important thing is that we learn from them and hopefully do better. I don't love criticism, but I know I can be wrong, even when I'm certain I'm right. Listening to others who disagree with me and are willing to criticize me is essential to piercing the seduction of certainty. Doubt, I've learned, is wisdom. And the older I get, the less I know for certain. Those leaders who never think they are wrong, who never question their judgments or perspectives, are a danger to the organizations and people they lead. In some cases, they are a danger to the nation and the world. I have learned that ethical leaders lead by seeing beyond the short term, beyond the urgent, and take every action with a view toward lasting values. They might find their values in a religious tradition, or a moral worldview, or even an appreciation of history. But those values, like truth, integrity, and respect for others, to name just a few, serve as external reference points for ethical leaders to make decisions, especially hard decisions in which there is no easy or good option. Those values are more important than what may pass for prevailing wisdom or the groupthink of a tribe. Those values are more important than the impulses of the bosses above them and the passions of the employees below them. They are more important than the organization's profitability and bottom line. Ethical leaders choose a higher loyalty to those core values over their own personal gain. Ethical leadership is also about understanding the truth about humans and our need for meaning. It is about building workplaces where standards are high and fear is low. Those are the kinds of cultures where people will feel comfortable speaking the truth to others as they seek excellence in themselves and the people around them. Without a fundamental commitment to the truth, especially in our public institutions and those who lead them, we are lost. As a legal principle, if people don't tell the truth, our justice system cannot function, and a society based on the rule of law begins to dissolve. As a leadership principle, if leaders don't tell the truth, or won't hear the truth from others, they cannot make good decisions, they cannot themselves improve, and they cannot inspire trust among those who follow them. The good news is that integrity and truth-telling can be modeled in powerful ways, shaping cultures of honesty, openness, and transparency. Ethical leaders can mold a culture by their words and, more important, by their actions, because they are always being watched. Unfortunately, the inverse is also true. Dishonest leaders have the same ability to shape a culture by showing their people dishonesty, corruption, and deception. A commitment to integrity and a higher loyalty to truth are what separate the ethical leader from those who just happen to occupy leadership roles. We cannot ignore the difference. I spent a lot of time thinking about the title of this book. In one sense, it came out of a bizarre dinner meeting at the White House, where a new president of the United States demanded my loyalty to him personally over my duties as FBI director to the American people. But in another, deeper sense, the title is the culmination of 4 decades in law. As a federal prosecutor, business lawyer, and working closely with 3 U.S. presidents. In all those jobs, I learned from those around me and tried to pass on to those I worked with that there is a higher loyalty in all of our lives. Not to a person, not to a party, not to a group. The higher loyalty is to lasting values, most important, the truth. I hope this book is useful in stimulating all of us to think about the values that sustain us and to search for leadership that embodies those values.
Introduction. Man's capacity for justice makes democracy possible, but man's inclination to injustice makes democracy necessary. Reinhold Niebuhr. There are 10 blocks between FBI headquarters and Capitol Hill, and each of them is fixed in my memory from countless shuttle missions up and down Pennsylvania Avenue. Riding past the National Archives, where tourists were lined up to see America's documents, the museum, with the words of the First Amendment carved into its stone front, and the t-shirt vendors and the food trucks, had become something of a ritual. It was February of 2017, and I was in the back row of a fully armored black FBI Suburban. The middle row of seats had been removed, so I sat in one of the 2 seats in the back. I'd gotten used to watching the world pass by through the small, dark, bulletproof side windows. I was on the way to yet another classified congressional briefing on the 2016 Russian election interference. Appearing in front of members of Congress was difficult on a good day, and usually disheartening. Nearly everyone appeared to take a side, and seemed to listen only to find the nuggets that fit their desired spin. They would argue with each other through you. Mr. Director, if someone said X, wouldn't that person be an idiot? And the reply would come through you as well. Mr. Director, if someone said that someone who said X was an idiot, wouldn't that person be the real idiot? When the subject involved the most contentious election in memory, the discussion in the aftermath was even more vicious, with few willing or able to put aside their political interests to focus on the truth. Republicans wanted to be assured that the Russians hadn't elected Donald Trump. Democrats, still reeling from the election results weeks before, wanted the opposite. There was little common ground. It was like having Thanksgiving dinner with a family eating together by court order. The FBI, with me as its director, was caught in the middle of the partisan bile. This was not really new. We had been sucked into the election starting in July 2015, when our seasoned professionals at the FBI began a criminal investigation of Hillary Clinton's handling of classified information on her personal email system. It was a time when even using the terms criminal and investigation was a source of needless controversy.
A year later, in July 2016, we began an investigation into whether there was a massive Russian effort to influence the presidential vote by hurting Clinton and helping elect Donald Trump. This was an unfortunate, if unavoidable, situation for the Bureau. Though it is part of the executive branch, the FBI is meant to stand apart from politics in American life. Its mission is to find the truth. To do that, the FBI can't be on anyone's side except the country's. Of course, members of the Bureau may have their own private political views, just like anybody else. But when its people rise in a courtroom or in Congress to report what they've found, they can't be seen as Republicans or Democrats or part of anyone's tribe. 40 years ago, Congress created a 10-year term for the FBI director to reinforce that independence. But in a capital city and a country torn by partisan conflict, the FBI's separateness was both alien and confusing and constantly tested. This placed an enormous strain on career professionals in the agency, especially as their motives were routinely being questioned. I glanced at Greg Brower, the FBI's new head of congressional affairs, who was riding to the Hill with me. Greg was a 53-year-old Nevadan with salt-and-pepper hair. We'd hired him from a law firm. Prior to that, he'd been the chief federal prosecutor in Nevada and also an elected state legislator. He knew the business of law enforcement and also the challenging and very different business of politics. His job was to represent the FBI in the shark tank of Congress. But Brower hadn't signed up for this kind of turmoil, which only grew after the shocking result of the 2016 election. Greg hadn't been part of the Bureau for long, so I was worried this craziness and stress might be getting to him. I half wondered whether he might fling open the door of the suburban and head for the hills. At a younger age, with fewer turns at the witness table in Congress, I might have considered exactly the same thing. As I looked at him, I assumed he was thinking what I was thinking. How did I end up here? I could see that worry on Brower's face, so I broke the silence. How great is this? I said in a booming voice that no doubt caught the attention of the agents in the front seats. Brower looked at me. We're in the shit, I said. Now he seemed confused. Did the FBI director just say shit? Yep, I had. We're waist-deep in the shit, I added with an exaggerated smile, holding my arms out to show just how deep it was. Where else would you want to be? Mangling the St. Crispin's Day speech from Shakespeare, I added, people abed in England tonight will wish they were here. He laughed and visibly lightened. I lightened too. Although I'm sure the thought of leaping from the speeding car still crossed Greg's mind, the tension was broken. We took a breath together. For a moment, we were two people on a road trip. Everything was going to be okay. Then the moment passed. We pulled up to the U.S. Capitol to talk about Putin and Trump and collusion allegations and secret dossiers and who knew what else. It was just another high-pressure moment in what was one of the craziest, most consequential, and even educational periods of my, and some might say the country's, life. And more than once I found myself thinking that same question, how on earth did I end up here? Chapter 1. The Life. To not think of dying is to not think of living. Jan Arden. The life begins with a lie. In 1992, I was an assistant U.S. attorney in New York City, and those were the words I heard from a senior member of one of the most notorious crime families in the United States. Salvatore Sammy the Bull Gravano was the highest-ranking American mobster ever to become a federal witness. He'd flipped to avoid a life sentence in jail, and also because he'd heard government tapes in which his boss, John Gotti, said bad things about him behind his back. Now in our custody, Gravano introduced me to the rules of mafia life. Membership in La Cosa Nostra, this thing of ours, became official only after an oath taken in a secret ceremony in front of the boss, underboss, and consigliere of the family. After the ceremony, the criminal would be known as a made man. The first question of the secret initiation was, "Do you know why you are here?" The chosen one was required to answer no, despite the fact that, as Gravano explained, only an idiot wouldn't know why the leaders of the family were gathered with him in the basement of some nightclub. For nearly two decades, the leaders of the American Mafia agreed there would be no new members. In 1957, they closed the books, a term reflecting that the process involved the actual sharing of paper among the mafia families, containing the aliases and real names of their members, because of serious concerns about quality control and penetration by informants. But in 1976, they agreed that each family could make 10 new members, and then the books would be closed again, with new members only admitted to replace those who died. For each family, those 10 were the most hardened all-star gangsters who had been frozen out for years. Gravano came into the mafia as part of that superclass. Inducting 10 new members after so long a shutdown obviously put burdens on the criminal enterprise. In a typical induction ceremony, an initiate is expected to hold in his cupped hands a flaming picture of a Catholic saint, stained with blood dripped from his trigger finger, and recite, "My soul should burn like this saint if I ever betray Cosa Nostra." Gravano recalled that when they reached the dramatic conclusion of his ceremony, he was forced to recite those words while holding a flaming, blood-stained tissue instead. The Gambino family hadn't bothered to get enough saint pictures to burn. Gravano's induction ceremony not only began with lies, it also ended with them. The boss reviewed for him the rules of American Cosa Nostra. No killing with explosives, no killing law enforcement, no killing other made men without official permission, no sleeping with another made man's wife, and no dealing in narcotics. As a general rule, the mafia did a good job following the first two rules. The American government would crush anyone who harmed innocents with explosions or killed law enforcement. But the promises not to kill made guys, bed their wives, or deal dope were lies. Gravano and his fellow mafia members routinely did all three. As my fellow prosecutor Patrick Fitzgerald explained it, they were like the rules against fighting in hockey. On the books is a no-no, but still a regular feature of the game. The closely related Sicilian mafia had a different rule, one that highlighted the centrality of dishonesty to the entire enterprise of organized crime on both sides of the Atlantic. Newly inducted members were told they were forbidden to lie to another made member, called a man of honor in Sicily, unless, and this was a big unless, it was necessary to lure him to his death. I once questioned another government witness, Sicilian mafia killer Francesco Marino Minoia, about this rule. "Franco," I said, "that means you can trust me unless we are about to kill you." "Yes," he replied, confused by my question. "Men of honor may only lie about the most important things." The life of lies. The silent circle of ascent. The boss in complete control. Loyalty oaths. An us versus them worldview. Lying about things large and small in service to some warped code of loyalty. These rules and standards were hallmarks of the mafia. But throughout my career, I'd be surprised how often I'd find them applied outside of it. My early career as a prosecutor, especially my role in confronting the mafia, reinforced my belief that I'd made the right career choice. The law hadn't been an obvious route for me. Ultimately, I chose a career in law enforcement because I believed it was the best way I could help other people, especially those suffering at the hands of the powerful, the crime bosses, the bullies. I didn't know it at the time, but it's possible that a life-altering experience I had when I was 16 years old, with a gun literally pointed to my head, made that choice inevitable. The gunman didn't know I was home that night. He'd been watching through a basement window and saw my parents say goodbye to the figure lying on the floor of the family room, lit only by the television's light. He probably thought that figure was my sister Trish, but it actually was my younger brother Pete. Trish had returned to college after fall break, and our youngest brother Chris was out at a Boy Scouts meeting. Minutes after my parents drove away, he kicked in the front door of our modest ranch-style house and headed straight downstairs. October 28, 1977, the day that changed my life, was a Friday. For most of the New York area, the prior few months were known as the Summer of Sam, when the city and its suburbs were gripped by a serial killer preying on couples sitting in cars. But for northern New Jersey, it was the summer and fall of the Ramsey Rapist. The attacker was named for the dozen attacks that had begun in a town called Ramsey. Our town, Sleepy Allendale, was just to the south. Hearing heavy steps on the creaking basement stairs and a low growl from our dog, Pete jumped up and moved out of view. But the gunman knew he was there. He pointed a handgun and ordered my brother to come out from his hiding place. He asked if anyone else was home. Pete lied and said no. At the time, I was a high school senior and a nerd, with few close friends. As if to prove it, I was home that night, finishing a piece for the school's literary magazine. It was to be a brilliant social satire of the cool kids, the bullies, and the suffocating peer pressure of high school. The piece was late and short on brilliance, but I had nothing else to do on a Friday night, so I sat at the desk in my little bedroom writing. In the basement with Pete, the gunman demanded to be taken up to the master bedroom. Shortly, I heard two sets of footsteps just outside my door, headed for my parents' room. Then I heard more sounds, as the closet and dresser drawers opened and closed. Out of annoyance and curiosity, I stood and opened the sliding wood door to the bathroom that connected my room to my parents'. Their room was brightly lit, and through the bathroom I could see Pete lying on the side of the bed, his head turned toward me, but with his eyes tightly closed. I stepped into the room, looked to my right, and froze. A stocky, middle-aged white guy wearing a knit cap was holding a gun and looking in my parents' closet. Time slowed down in a way I've never again experienced. I lost my sight for an instant. It returned in a strange haze, and my entire body pulsed as if my heart had grown too big for my chest. Spotting me, the gunman moved quickly to Pete and put his knee in the middle of his back, using his left hand to push the gun barrel against my 15-year-old brother's head. He turned to me. "You move, kid, and I'll blow his head off." I didn't move. The gunman had angry words for Pete. "I thought you told me nobody else was home." The gunman then stepped off Pete and ordered me to lie on the bed next to my brother. Standing at my feet, he demanded to know where he might find money. I later learned that Pete had money in his jeans pocket as we lay there and never gave it up. I gave it all up. I told him every place I could possibly think of. Piggy banks, wallets, dollar coins received from grandparents for special events, everything. Armed with my leads, the gunman left us lying on the bed and went searching. A short time later, he returned and simply stood above us, pointing his gun in our direction. I don't know how long he pointed it without a sound, but it was long enough that the moment changed me. I was certain I was about to die. Hopelessness, panic, fear smothered me. I began to pray silently, knowing that my life was about to end. In the next instant, a strange wave of cold washed over me, and my fear disappeared. I began reasoning, thinking that if he shot Pete first, I would roll off the bed and try to grab the gunman's legs. And then I began to speak, to lie more precisely. The lies came pouring out. I explained how estranged we were from our parents, hated them, actually, didn't care what he took from them, wouldn't tell anyone he had been there. I lied again and again and again. The gunman told me to shut up and ordered both of us to our feet. He then began pushing us down the narrow hallway from my parents' room, pausing to search rooms and closets he passed. I was now convinced, temporarily at least, that I was going to live, and began trying to get a clear look at his face so I could tell the police about him. He jammed me in the back several times with the gun barrel, telling me to turn my head away from him. I again began talking, telling him over and over that he should just put us someplace, and we would stay there so he could get away. I began racking my brain trying to think of such a place in the house, a place where we could be locked. Against all reason, I suggested the basement bathroom, telling him we couldn't open the small window because my father had sealed it for the winter. That was only partly true. My dad had put clear plastic on the window frame to reduce the draft, but the window opened simply by raising the bottom half. He took us to the basement bathroom, motioned us inside, and said, "Tell your mommy and daddy you've been good little boys." He wedged something against the bathroom door to keep us from escaping. We heard the door to the garage open and close as the gunman left. I started to shudder as the adrenaline wore off. Shaking, I looked at the little window, and suddenly the gunman's face filled it. He was checking the window from the outside. The sight made me gasp for air. After his face disappeared, I told Pete we were going to stay there until Mom and Dad came home. Pete had other ideas. He said, "You know who that is? He's going to hurt other people. We've got to get help." In my shaky state, I don't think it fully dawned on me what Pete was saying, or how the evening might have played out if our 19-year-old sister Trish actually had been home. Instead, I resisted. I was afraid. Pete argued with me briefly and then announced he was leaving. He pulled the plastic from the window, turned the half-moon latch, and raised the window open. He swung himself out feet first and into the backyard. Though it was probably only a second or two, in my memory I stood for a long time contemplating the open window and the dark night. Should I stay or should I follow? I swung my feet through the window. The moment they hit the cold dirt of my mother's garden, I heard the gunman shouting. I dropped to my hands and knees and crawled furiously into the thick bushes at the back of the house. The gunman already had grabbed Pete and now was shouting toward me, "Come out of there, kid, or your brother's getting hurt." I emerged, and the gunman berated me for lying to him. Fresh out of another clever lie, I replied, "We'll go right back in," and I moved toward the open window. "Too late," he said, "against the fence." For the second time that night, I thought I was going to die. That was until I heard our neighbor's huge Siberian husky, Sundance, bound into our backyard with his owner, Steve Murray, the high school German teacher and football coach, bounding in after him. The next seconds are a blur in my memory. I remember running from the gunman into my house with Pete and Coach Murray close behind and then slamming the door behind me. We locked the door, leaving the gunman outside to terrorize Coach's wife and mother, who had followed him toward the commotion at our house, a move that makes me cringe with guilt even decades later. We then raced up the stairs, turned out all the lights, and arming ourselves. I held a large butcher knife. We didn't have 911 in those days, so we dialed the operator, and I asked to be connected to the police. I spoke to a dispatcher who kept telling me to calm down. I explained that I couldn't calm down, that a man with a gun was at our house and he was coming back and we needed help, now. We waited by the front door in the dark and debated going after the gunman. A police car pulled up in front of my house. We blinked the front lights and the car came to a stop. We ripped open the front door and ran straight at the officer, me barefoot and holding a large butcher knife. The officer quickly stepped from his car and his hand went to his weapon. I shouted, "No, no," and pointed toward the Murray's house. "There he goes, he has a gun." The gunman burst from the Murray's front door and took off running toward the nearby woods. As police cars from many jurisdictions converged on our little street, I jumped on my Schwinn 10-speed barefoot and pedaled the quarter mile to the church hall where my parents were taking ballroom dancing lessons. I jumped off the bike, letting it crash, ripped open the church hall door, and yelled, "Dad!" at the top of my lungs. Everyone stopped, and the crowd moved toward me, my mother and father in the lead. My mother started crying the moment she saw my face. The police didn't find the Ramsey rapist that night. A suspect was arrested days later, but the case was never made, and he was released. But that night, the long string of Ramsey rapist robberies and sexual assaults stopped. My encounter with the Ramsey rapist brought me years of pain. I thought about him every night for at least 5 years, not most nights, every night. And I slept with a knife at hand for far longer. I couldn't see it at the time, but the terrifying experience was, in its own way, also an incredible gift. Believing, knowing in my mind, that I was going to die, and then surviving, made life seem like a precious, delicate miracle. As a high school senior, I started watching sunsets, looking at buds on trees, and noticing the beauty of our world. That feeling lasts to this day, though sometimes it expresses itself in ways that might seem corny to people who, fortunately, never had the experience of measuring their time on this earth in seconds. The Ramsey rapist taught me at an early age that many of the things we think are valuable have no value. Whenever I speak to young people, I suggest they do something that might seem a little odd. Close your eyes, I say. Sit there and imagine you're at the end of your life. From that vantage point, the smoke of striving for recognition and wealth is cleared. Houses, cars, awards on the wall, who cares? You're about to die. Who do you want to have been? I tell them that I hope some of them decide to have been people who use their abilities to help those who needed it. The weak, the struggling, the frightened, the bullied. standing for something, making a difference. That is true wealth. The Ramsey rapist didn't drive me to law enforcement in any conscious way, at least not immediately. I still thought I wanted to be a doctor, and became a pre-med student with a chemistry major at the College of William and Mary. But one day I was headed to a chem lab and noticed the word death on a bulletin board. I stopped. It was an advertisement for a class in the religion department, which shared the building with the chemistry department. I took the course, and everything changed. The class allowed me to explore a subject of intense interest to me, and to see how religions of the world dealt with death. I added religion as a new second major. The religion department introduced me to the philosopher and theologian Reinhold Niebuhr, whose work resonated with me deeply. Niebuhr saw the evil in the world, understood that human limitations make it impossible for any of us to really love another as ourselves, but still painted a compelling picture of our obligation to try to seek justice in a flawed world. He never heard country music artist Billy Currington sing, "God is great, beer is good, and people are crazy," but he would have appreciated the lyric, and although it wouldn't make the song a hit, he probably would have added, "And you still must try to achieve a measure of justice in our imperfect world." And justice, Niebuhr believed, could best be sought through the instruments of government power. Slowly it dawned on me that I wasn't going to be a doctor after all. Lawyers participate much more directly in the search for justice. That route, I thought, might be the best way to make a difference. Chapter 2. This Thing of Ours. Keep your friends close, but your enemies closer. Al Pacino as Michael Corleone, The Godfather, Part 2. There are 94 federal districts in the United States, each presided over by a United States attorney nominated by the president and conferred by the Senate. The offices vary greatly in size and reach. The office in Manhattan, known as the Southern District of New York, is both one of the largest and the most well-regarded. It's famous for its energy and its expansive sense of its own ability to bring cases. The office has long been accused of considering only one question relevant to its claims of jurisdiction. Did it happen on the earth? I joined the United States Attorney's Office in Manhattan in 1987. It was my dream job. I would work for a man who was already becoming legendary, Rudy Giuliani. When I graduated from the University of Chicago Law School in 1985, I still didn't know exactly what kind of lawyer I wanted to be. After my second year, I had applied to be a federal law clerk, a 1 or 2 year apprenticeship working as an aide to a federal trial judge. In my final year of law school, I finally got one, with a new federal judge in Manhattan. The judge, John M. Walker Jr., would encourage us to sit in the courtroom and watch if there was an interesting case going on. In the spring of 1986, the government was trying to use a new federal law to detain a defendant without bail on the grounds that he was a danger to the community. This wasn't just any defendant, but Anthony Fat Tony Salerno, the boss of the Genovese crime family, one of the 5 New York Italian mafia gangs. Fat Tony was straight out of a mob movie. He was overweight, bald, walked with a cane, and kept an unlit cigar in his mouth, even in court. He had a gravelly voice and would use it to call out in court to supplement something his lawyer had said. "That's an outrage, Your Honor!" he erupted from his seat. His co-defendant, Vincent Fish Cafaro, with his narrow face and dark eyes, actually looked like a fish to my 25-year-old eyes. To prove Salerno was a danger to the community and bail should be withheld, the federal prosecutors offered tapes of conversations made by an FBI bug planted under a table at Fat Tony's social club, the Palma Boys, located in an Italian enclave in East Harlem. Salerno could be heard talking about ordering beatings and killings and being quite clear about his role. "Who am I? I'm the fucking boss." The case showed that in a mafia family, the boss was not to be questioned. His words about life and death meant someone was going to die. And the worst sin was betraying the family, becoming a rat. The mafia was all about loyalty, and you left it when you left this earth, whether by natural causes or otherwise. Only rats left the mafia alive. I sat there mesmerized. as the two federal prosecutors, both assistant United States attorneys, made the case against Fat Tony. They had tapes and witness testimony about Fat Tony and Fish ordering hits, breaking legs, intimidating unions, and running a mob family. The defense argued it was all just tough talk, but the prosecutors presented powerful evidence undermining that preposterous claim. The two prosecutors were only a few years older than I was. They stood straight, spoke clearly and candidly. They didn't overstate. They didn't posture. They seemed to have no other motivation than tackling injustice and telling the truth. I was struck by lightning. This is what I want to do with my life, I thought. I would join a law firm in New York and get the extra year of experience I needed before I could apply to be a federal prosecutor. And it would be a year I would never forget because of one person. I was a 25-year-old lawyer in New York at a law firm that did me the great favor of shipping me off to Madison, Wisconsin, for most of that year to work on an incredibly complicated and boring insurance case. It was a gift, though, because Richard L. Cates was the so-called local counsel on the case, which was being litigated in state court in Madison. Cates, then 61, was hired to offer local knowledge to the big-shot, big-city lawyers who were going to handle the case. I saw in Dick kindness and toughness, confidence and humility. It would take me decades to realize that those pairs were the bedrock of great leadership. I also saw in this man of extraordinary judgment a fierce commitment to balance. Dick died in 2011 after a life that began in a New York orphanage and was spent seeking joy in his work and his relationships. He married the love of his life, had 5 kids, went in and out of public service, including 2 stints in the Marine Corps during wartime, and never lost his drive, in the words of his son, to protect the weak from being crushed by the strong. He moved his family to a farm outside Madison so his children didn't get soft. He rode his bike miles to work. He played with his kids endlessly, and then with their many children. Despite all the darkness he had seen, Dick found life and people endlessly interesting and would laugh about both. He would take a deposition with nothing in front of him, not even a piece of paper, beginning the session by giving the witness a big smile and saying, "Tell me your story." His mind and memory let him track the story and ask follow-up questions for hours. I don't think Dick Cates taught me a single explicit lesson in the year we worked together. At least I don't remember any. But for a year, as a brand new lawyer and soon-to-be husband, I sat at his side and watched him. I watched him laugh at pretension and at pressure. I watched him make common-sense decisions when big-city lawyers were tied up in knots of overthinking and arrogance. I watched him light up at the mere mention of his wife and children and grandchildren. I watched him move heaven and earth to be at their events, their dinners, their projects. I watched him not care that he earned a fraction of what the New York and Los Angeles lawyers on the case were paid. He was a happy man. This is the person I want to be, I thought. My effort at life plagiarism has been imperfect, but the lessons were priceless. That is what it means to lead and keep a life. I'm so glad I went to a big law firm is not something you hear often, but I am. Assistant United States Attorney is a non-political career lawyer position in which the lawyer represents the United States in criminal or civil cases in the district where he works. In 1987, I was assigned to the criminal division. My job was to assist federal agents, FBI, DEA, ATF, Secret Service, or United States Postal Inspectors, in investigating federal crimes and, where appropriate, bringing charges and prosecuting the cases in court. Over the next 6 years, I investigated and tried all kinds of cases, ranging from mail theft, drug dealing, and bank robbery, to complex frauds, arms exporting, racketeering, and murder. My first case involved the attempted murder of federal ATF agents by a drug gang during the execution of a search warrant. The dealers had fired down on the agents from a fire escape as the feds tried to penetrate a fortified drug location. In an effort to convince a reluctant witness to cooperate against the gang, the lead agent on the case drove me to an apartment building in northern Manhattan, turf controlled by drug gangs. He said that if she trusted the prosecutor who would speak to her in court, it might convince her to testify. We climbed 6 flights of stairs to her apartment, and the agent knocked on the door. The witness opened the door and admitted us to a small apartment. She led us through the front room, where a man in his 20s sat on a stool with his back to the wall. He didn't move or speak, but stared at us intensely. In a back room, we spoke privately and quietly with the woman. I made my best case for her to cooperate, but she wouldn't commit. As we walked out, the man on the stool remained motionless, again, just staring. As the agent and I left the building and crossed the sidewalk to the agent's car, I said that the guy on the stool looked pretty scary and guessed that he likely had a gun in the back of his waistband. Good thing that guy knew we were armed, so he didn't do anything, I said. Assistant U.S. attorneys did not carry firearms. That was the agent's job. The agent whipped his head around. You had a gun? Because I forgot mine under the seat. He reached into the car and retrieved his weapon. It would be a long time before I would tell my wife about that little field trip. There was something of an unwritten code about working in the office of Rudy Giuliani, as I suppose there is in most organizations. In his case, the message was that Rudy was the star at the top, and the successes of the office flowed in his direction. You violated this code at your peril. Giuliani had extraordinary confidence, and as a young prosecutor, I found his brash style exciting, which was part of what drew me to his office. I loved it that my boss was on magazine covers standing on the courthouse steps with his hands on his hips, as if he ruled the world. It fired me up. Prosecutors almost never saw the great man in person, so I was especially pumped when he stopped by my office early in my career. Shortly after I'd been assigned to an investigation that touched a prominent New York figure who dressed in shiny tracksuits and sported a Nobel-sized medallion around his neck. The state of New York was investigating Al Sharpton for alleged embezzlement from his charity, and I was assigned to see if there was a federal angle to the case. I had never even seen Rudy on my floor, and now he was at my very door. He wanted me to know that he was personally following the investigation and knew I would do a good job. My heart thumped with anxiety and excitement as he gave me this pep talk standing in the doorway. He was counting on me. He turned to leave, then stopped. "Oh, and I want the fucking medal," he said, and then walked away. But we never made a federal case. The state authorities charged Sharpton, and he was acquitted after a trial. The medal stayed with its owner. It took me a while to realize that Giuliani's confidence was not leavened with a whole lot of humility. The cost of that imbalance was that there was very little oxygen left for others. An early clue was my first press conference. I had worked with the FBI to bust a criminal ring that was stealing SUVs from Manhattan parking garages and loading them on shipping containers in the Bronx. The containers were then hustled onto ships bound for Africa or the Caribbean, where the cars were resold. The investigation, led by Special Agent Mary Ellen Beekman, who had been a Roman Catholic nun before joining the Bureau, had penetrated the operation and was secretly photographing the loading. Mary Ellen's specialty was car theft rings and convincing hardened criminals to become government informants. And although she didn't approve of the foul language so common in law enforcement, she was an extraordinary interrogator. She had retained from her prior career the ability to use guilt in powerful ways to make thugs melt. The thieves in this case were so efficient, the cars were on their way out of the country before being reported stolen. It was a cool case, and the FBI and Giuliani decided to do a press conference. My supervisor told me I was to stand behind the podium while Giuliani, the NYPD commissioner, and the head of the FBI's New York office spoke to the press. I was not, under any circumstances, to speak or move. He then repeated a line I had heard before. The most dangerous place in New York is between Rudy and a microphone. I stood frozen in the back, looking like an extra from a basketball movie who had wandered onto the wrong set. Though Giuliani's confidence was exciting, it fed an imperial style that severely narrowed the circle of people with whom he interacted, something I didn't realize was dangerous until much later. A leader needs the truth, but an emperor does not consistently hear it from his underlings. Rudy's demeanor left a trail of resentment among the dozens of federal judges in Manhattan, many of whom had worked in that U.S. attorney's office. They thought he made the office about one person, himself, and used publicity about his cases as a way to foster his political ambitions rather than doing justice. It was a resentment that was still palpable when I became the chief federal prosecutor in Manhattan and sat in Giuliani's chair a dozen years later. One of Giuliani's top priorities was organized crime, a focus that actually started well before he took office. His prosecutors brought cases against individual mob bosses like Salerno and also charged the leaders of the five Cosa Nostra families who sat on the commission, which divided up criminal money among the families and refereed disputes. Most important, Rudy's office brought civil cases to allow the government to take control of large trade unions, the Teamsters, electricians, carpenters, and dock workers among them, to starve the mafia of its major source of cash and influence, which came from using unions to extort money from legitimate businesses. That successful effort to destroy La Cosa Nostra continued long after Rudy stepped down as United States Attorney to run for political office. The most powerful of the five mafia families was the Gambino family. Like the other families, it traced its roots to Sicilian immigrants to the United States who had found wealth and power terrorizing first their fellow immigrants and then entire neighborhoods and cities. In an early effort to battle the mafia, in 1946, the American government deported a famous mobster, Charles Lucky Luciano, who was sent back to Sicily, where he promptly energized and reorganized the mafia on that island, solidifying a transatlantic link between criminal organizations that would facilitate a thriving heroin trade for decades. At the heart of that drug trade in the 1970s and 1980s was a man named John Gambino, a fluent Sicilian speaker who served as the channel or connection between the Sicilian mafia families and the American Gambino family, of which he was a senior leader. I was lucky to be part of a case against the channel and the Gambino family as one of two prosecutors in the case of United States versus John Gambino. The case had been started by two other prosecutors who had to step aside for personal reasons. By that point, I'd risen to be a supervisor in the office, and I recruited another prosecutor, Patrick Fitzgerald, a close friend since our days in law school, to work on the case. A graduate of Harvard Law, Pat was the son of Irish immigrants and had grown up in a small apartment in Brooklyn. His father worked as a doorman, and Pat would sometimes substitute for him when home from school. He had a quick wit and no pretense at all, which is why he had no problem crashing on our couch and borrowing our beer at a New Jersey beach house some friends and I rented during summer break from law school. Fitzgerald joined the United States Attorney's Office in 1988, a year after I did, and I was assigned to supervise him during his first federal criminal jury trial. He was a legendary slob with an uncanny memory. In his trial cart, a modified shopping cart used to move documents and exhibits back and forth to court, I saw a messy stack of key documents for the case. "You gotta put these in folders," I coached. He nodded. I returned later to find that he had put each document in an unlabeled file folder and returned them to the stack. Somehow he still knew where each document was. By the time the Gambino case came around, we were both veteran prosecutors and on the phone discussing possible partners for him because the Gambino case required two prosecutors. I wasn't a candidate because my family was planning to move out of the New York area. My wife, Patrice, was more accustomed to the cornfields of her native Iowa and the leafy suburbs of Northern Virginia and had endured New York City for years. Early in our marriage, when the opportunity to work for Rudy Giuliani had come up, I reneged on a deal that we would raise our family in Virginia. So Patrice and I had lived in the New Jersey suburbs for 6 years, first in a shoebox apartment over a bike shop, then in a modest two-family house rental. With our two growing daughters, half of a house had become too cramped. As I stood in the kitchen talking to Fitzgerald, Patrice was listening to my end of the conversation. Suddenly she interrupted, asking me to hang up because she needed to speak with me. I told Pat I would call him back. "That sounds like the case of a lifetime," she said. "It is," I replied. "I'll stay for that. I'll stay for you to do that case with one of your best friends. Call him back and tell him you found his partner." We postponed our move for a year. Pat and I spent months learning the case and the mafia. We started by talking to the one man in the United States who knew La Cosa Nostra best. Luckily for us, his office was down the hall from ours. Kenneth McCabe was a former NYPD detective who joined the United States Attorney's Office in Manhattan as an investigator early in the war on the Mafia. A gentle giant of a man, standing 6'4" and weighing more than 250 pounds, with a deep voice and thick New York accent, Kenny knew every Mafia member by sight, name, and nickname. And he knew all this because for over 20 years, with the NYPD and then the United States Attorney's Office, he had conducted endless surveillance of weddings, wakes, and funerals, and done hundreds of interviews with Mafia members and turncoats. For reasons that were never clear to me, the FBI Mafia squads in New York had long been reluctant to cover Mafia funerals and weddings. My guess is that agents didn't want to come in from the suburbs to cover events of marginal value. They were always on weekends or at night. McCabe saw it differently and believed that that was where you could learn the most, just by watching. So we watched and photographed in all weather, weekends and nights for years. The Mafia also knew Kenny McCabe, and in a strange way, respected him as a noble adversary. Kenny understood the peculiar need of Mafia members to believe they were people of honor, so he treated them with what they saw as respect, by never serving a subpoena at their homes and never embarrassing them with an arrest in front of their wives or children. As a result, members considering betraying La Cosa Nostra would frequently contact McCabe first. Kenny McCabe taught us La Cosa Nostra 101, then traveled with us and the FBI case agents to meet the Mafia turncoats hidden around the country, who were to be the bedrock of our case. One of those turncoats was Sammy the Bull Gravano, the former underboss, number two, of the Gambino crime family. I met Gravano for the first time when Pat, Kenny, and I traveled to a special federal prison for witnesses in a remote part of the United States in 1992. I remember being slightly anxious waiting for the Gambino family underboss to walk into the room. How would it go? How would he react to these two young prosecutors? What would it be like to meet with a man who had committed, by his own admission, 19 murders? The diminutive Gravano stepped into the room in prison garb and rubber-soled shoes with no laces. His quick eyes swept the space and settled on the mountainous McCabe. He didn't need an introduction. "It's an honor," he said to Kenny, extending his hand. Gravano then turned and spoke to me and Fitzgerald. If we were with McCabe, we were okay. Gravano was a critical witness. The U.S. government took a man who'd climbed to the top of the Mafia by lying and forced him to tell the truth to destroy La Cosa Nostra on both sides of the Atlantic. His life of lies and murder became essential to the search for truth and justice. When he finished cooperating, he was released to life in the witness security program. Not surprisingly, he ended up back in prison for new crimes committed in his new identity. Gravano taught me a great deal about the Mafia's culture and how, as I noted earlier, the life begins with a lie. So too did Sicilian Mafia killer Francesco Marino Minoia. Like Gravano, Franco Minoia was confused about the U.S. justice system. He wondered why, for example, Fitzgerald and I insisted upon knowing all acts of violence in which he had engaged before we would present him as a witness in an American court. Of course, we were obligated by American law to disclose information that might call into question the credibility of our witnesses. Although confused, he was also required by his immunity agreement with the Italian government to cooperate with the Americans. So he reviewed in great detail all 25 murders in which he had personally participated. Many Mafia murders in Sicily in the 1980s involved luring the doomed man of honor to a remote location and then strangling him to death. We sat for hours listening to Minoia matter-of-factly recount the elaborate ruses and brutal final minutes of his work. He believed strangulation, which required the assistance of four other strong men, to be an honorable way to kill, in contrast to the cowardly use of a gun at a distance. Minoia explained to us the complicated rule that Mafia members were forbidden to reveal themselves directly as members of La Cosa Nostra. As in the American Mafia, the identity was to be secret, and one member could only be introduced to another member by a third member known to both. This rule against revelation once played a strange role in a double murder in which Minoia had participated. He said that he and other members of his Mafia family had been assigned to investigate some unauthorized crimes that had taken place on his family's turf. They dutifully rounded up the usual suspects, zeroing in on two men. They took the two to a remote location and interrogated each separately. Even after using classic techniques like the prisoner's dilemma, assuring each suspect that the other was going to implicate him, the mafia members did not obtain confessions. The two interrogation teams conferred, and by Minoia's account concluded that these two criminals were actually innocent of the misdeeds in question. We asked, what happened next? "We strangled them," came his matter-of-fact reply. "Why would you do that?" exclaimed Pat Fitzgerald. "They had been innocent." "Because by our questioning we had revealed ourselves to be Cosa Nostra. We could not let them live with that knowledge." "So what was the point of the questioning in the first place?" I interjected. Minoia furrowed the placid brow that framed his sad eyes and replied, "I do not understand. It was our obligation." Minoia was the first mafia killer we called to the witness stand against John Gambino. We followed him by presenting another Sicilian mafia killer, Gaspare Mutolo, who also had become a cooperating witness. Our Italian colleagues had been hiding him in an empty convent in the Italian countryside, and prior to his testimony, Fitzgerald and I, along with FBI agents, flew to Rome to interview him. As we ate homemade pasta prepared for us by this professional killer, Mutolo laid out his life as a Cosa Nostra man of honor. I wish I could say I felt something different when I was in the presence of a mass murderer, handing me a cup of espresso in an empty convent. In the movies, some foreboding music might play in the background or the light might dim. But there was none of that. Evil has an ordinary face. It laughs, it cries, it deflects, it rationalizes, it makes great pasta. These killers were people who had crossed an indelible line in human experience by intentionally taking another life. They all constructed their own narrative to explain and justify their killing. None of them saw themselves as bad people. To a person, they all said the same thing. The first time was really, really hard. After that, not so much. Mutolo had killed so many people that he couldn't remember them all. After naming nearly 30, he added that we should assume there were 7 or 8 more. At one point, he recalled killing a man named Galatolo. Then he recalled hitting another man named Galatolo with a meat cleaver, but the man had not died. On the witness stand, he remembered that he had actually killed yet another man named Galatolo, making it 2 Galatolos killed and 1 Galatolo merely hit in the chest with a meat cleaver. During the day, I was in court as Mutolo testified, spilling the secrets of the mafia's reign of death and crime, while my evenings were spent meeting with Sammy the Bull Gravano in a safe house controlled by the United States Marshals Service. Gravano had previously testified in Brooklyn federal court against family boss John Gotti, where defense lawyers made much of his involvement in 19 homicides. Sammy the Bull didn't know it, but part of our strategy was to present the mob killers in such a way that the jury would actually be bored with the details of mob murders by the time Gravano, our star witness, hit the stand. Our hope was that this would make Gravano more palatable to the jury. Gravano, though, saw this as a bit of professional embarrassment. One evening I walked into a safe house conference room. Gravano threw a New York tabloid onto the table before me with a look of disgust. He'd been reading an article about the grim body count of our Sicilian killer witnesses, which was far higher than his own. Pointing at the paper, Gravano barked, "Jesus, Jimmy, you're making me look like a fucking schoolgirl." Thanks to the work of dozens of investigators and prosecutors, La Cosa Nostra's grip on unions was broken, its leaders jailed, and its dominance on both sides of the Atlantic shattered. John Gambino's trial jury actually hung 11-1 on all the most serious charges in suspicious circumstances, but he pled guilty before his retrial, was sentenced to 15 years in federal prison, and has since died. There are still people in New York who call themselves Italian Mafia, but it's a motley collection of low-level criminals that would embarrass Lucky Luciano. It more closely resembles The Sopranos, without the therapist. Chapter 3. The Bully. Courage is fire, and bullying is smoke. Benjamin Disraeli. Mafia members may dress and talk in distinctive ways, but they're part of a fairly common species, the bully. All bullies are largely the same, They threaten the weak to feed some insecurity that rages inside them. I know. I've seen it up close. When people see me, their first reaction is always to make note of my height. At 6'8", I'm hard to miss. But when I was a kid, I was anything but imposing. In fact, when my parents moved us from Yonkers, New York,